A book that I'm sure will be peeking out from the top of many a Christmas stocking this year is the 20th anniversary edition of Nigella Lawson's How to Eat. A culinary classic, it's stuffed full of mouth-watering recipes that read like love letters to food, laced with a dash of Epicurean philosophy. And the icing on the cake is that How to Eat is now also a feast for the ears, with Nigella herself narrating the audiobook version.
The great culinary renaissance we hear so much about has done many things, given us extra virgin olive oil, better restaurants and gastro porn, but it hasn't taught us how to cook. Of course, standards have improved. Better ingredients are available to us now, and more people know about them. Food and cookery have become more than respectable. They are fashionable. But the renaissance of British cookery, as it was relentlessly tagged in the late 1980s, started in the restaurant and filtered its way into the home. This is the wrong way round.
I'm delighted to say that Nigella has joined me here in the studio. I'll have to admit that I was a little sceptical as to having an audio version of How to Eat because I've heard some pretty bad renditions of cookbooks in the past. But it was such a pleasant surprise because the conversational way that you write really does come through and brings the recipes to life. And as someone who can't actually read the paper copies of your cookbooks anymore, I was delighted to have it. Were you pleasantly surprised yourself?
Well, you know, I was. I mean, I went through various ranges of emotions doing it because it's quite odd, actually, speaking in a voice that you had when you were younger, a lot younger, of different, not a different person, but, you know, a different stage in your life, and yet you're doing it now. And that was odd. I really wanted to do it, but I did wonder how it would work. But when I started doing it, apart from, you know, that slight being in a slight time warp, which went away very quickly, and I felt quite immersed in it as I did it. I mean, it took a long time. It's a long book, and I'm not trained, so I did feel at some stage I had forgotten how to use my mouth and talk at some of it. But I did enjoy it, and actually, it reminded me as well about how much of cooking really is about having a conversation about food. And of course, there are certain recipes there that might be hard to follow, the baking ones, say, because you want to get weights and so forth. But so much of the rest of the cooking of the book is really, look, this is an idea. These flavours go well together. And I think it's quite, as you say, it's conversational and it's reflective. And I enjoyed feeling I was having that conversation actually out loud.
Absolutely. And I've been roasting chickens for the best part of 35 years now. But it was so nice to listen to your classic roast chicken recipe and just be reminded gently of all the things that I was meant to do, rather than have to look down a list of instructions and think, yes, it's exactly this amount and exactly that amount. It's learning through play, actually.
Exactly, exactly. And also, it's, and I think this is very much what I was trying to say in the book, one of the many things, as you know, it's a long book and I do a lot of talking, but also it's not just learning through play, it's actually saying, actually trust your instincts, because, you know, I might like a herb you don't like. That doesn't mean you can't do the recipe. And it really is about saying cooking is about learning to trust your instincts, which means you have to repeat things a certain amount so you get the feel of the recipe. But then it's all over to you. And I think that's very important. And I think that the tyranny of the recipe can stop people from enjoying the playful side of cooking.
Yes, and there's no wrong way of doing it. It's just what's right for your taste and the taste that you're going to be
serving up. And, you know, you have to allow for failure because you have to take risks in cooking or in the rest of life. So that if a recipe doesn't work one day because you've decided you're going to add something you haven't added before to it and it doesn't work, you've learned a lesson there. And generally speaking, it just means maybe your supper's not quite as nice as you'd hoped, but it's not going to be disastrous.
You can salvage situations that you might otherwise...
Anything except for oversalting. That's my rule in life.
There's absolutely nothing you can do about it.
Well, if it's slightly oversalted, you can often add a bit of lemon juice or something because the sharpness kind of balances it. But generally, if it really is oversalted, that's it. You know, I think, and I've tried, and I like salty food, but I think that's probably it.
And it was a straight read from the original text. You didn't feel you had to change anything when you came back to it?
I changed some things, but I didn't, not in an editorial way. I think sometimes I had written sentences which I just ran out of breath reading, so I just truncated in that way. I left some remarks about where to find ingredients were slightly outdated, but I didn't actually change any of the words, even if... It did mean it really did still belong to 1998 and not 2018 or whatever, because in a way that's the book came out of that time, and I think to change its character would be wrong. So I didn't. Apart from the rest of it was just like the normal sort of editing you have to do and changing something that people read on the page to reading through their ears in a way. So that was just. It just happened, and sometimes I found I changed things without meaning to as I read. But I try to keep it, respect the book it was, which is odd when it's your own book, you know, because every now and then I'd say to the engineer, you know, the sound engineer, do you think I can change that? And he kept saying, it's your book.
When you originally wrote the book, did you type it out or did you dictate it? Because it does have that lovely
conversation. Oh, I typed it out. I was a journalist from quite a young age, and not that young, but, you know, early 20s. And when I started writing, I always wrote longhand, and I got too emotional with it. I felt like it was a continuation of my bloodstream. So then I started typing, and after a while, I feel that although I do think when I talk, I actually start thinking a lot when my fingers are, you know, tip-tapping away, not pretty badly, on a typewriter or a computer. And so I do feel that doesn't stop me being conversational. And I think it's a mixture. It's both conversational but not as well. You know, writing in a way has to seem conversational, but I suppose you're allowed to play with language in a way that... you might not always if you were just talking.
And do you feel that much has changed in our attitude towards eating, cooking, food over the last 20 years?
Well, I think a lot has changed. I don't think I've changed an awful lot. And I mean, it amused me how many recipes are in the book that I feel like you could come across now. But not because I was being enormously prescient, but because, for example, I have a recipe for... some kale with chorizo and a poached egg. It's kind of hipster menu 101. But the thing is, then I wrote about it because I was lamenting that kale, or curly kale, I was brought up calling it curly kale, I was lamenting the fact that it had sort of fallen out of favour and you could never find it. So it was really writing about the food I had eaten and perhaps adding things that were a bit different. I think food was very polarised for various reasons, but I think... I'm glad to say there is still room for, I suppose, the greedy exploration of a home cook, and that's still possible now. And if anything, I think when I wrote the book, the world was so dominated by chefs. And I think in this country, at any rate, we've got quite a lot of home cooks who write about food and tell their stories. And I think storytelling is essential, and there seems to be more room for that now. So I think a lot of it's changed in a good way. I think faddishness never goes away, and if anything, it's become more extreme. But then, whatever happens, there's always a reaction. There's room for so many different sorts of cooking.
Yes, and I mean, certainly you were the cook who gave me confidence to try what I thought might work, or throw what I found in the back of the fridge into the pot, and taste throughout my cooking and be confident just to run with how I felt.
I'm glad.
Yeah, and it's how I've taught my children to cook as well. And I think there's far more of that on TV than the rigid chemistry experiments that we sometimes have been subjected to. You're still writing new material as well?
Well, in theory, I've actually been on the road quite a lot this year. So I'm not actually writing something now, but I have something on the back burner.
Are there plans to make audio versions of Nigella Bites and the other books as well?
Well, not as far as I know. I suppose the publishers will wait and see what happens with the audio edition of How to Eat. How to Eat lends itself more. I think that possibly if I were thinking of other books, there would be Feast or Kitchen I would do before Nigella Bites, say, because I think, again, there's a more discursive elements within the book. There's more of a narrative voice.
Now, I know that your book is going to be peeking out of many a Christmas stocking. I think possibly my own daughter might be getting a copy. And coming on to Christmas, what are you planning for this Christmas? You've revolutionised the use of goose fat and prunes in Nigella's Christmas kitchen. Is there a secret ingredient this year?
Well, I'm actually quite traditional at Christmas. And, you know, I repeat very much the familiar recipes. I think ritual is a very important part of human life, and Christmas is where it really, you know, remains. That I feel I have to have, you know, the turkey and so forth. And I'm ever since I started brining it those years back, I'm not going to change the way I do it. I might change the spices. I don't think so. I'm sticking pretty much to the traditional way of doing it, well, my traditional way of doing it. But of course, until I start cooking it this year, I won't know what I want to add. I always have to go off-piste a bit and, you know, add something extra at the last minute, because that's how I cook. So I don't know. I'll know for next year.
Is your eye drawn to the unfamiliar vegetable or the forgotten vegetable as you walk through your local greengrocer and you think, oh, that might go nicely?
Well, yes, I actually did see some Brussels sprout tops the other day, which I do like, and I did think that would be rather a nice accompaniment as well to the Brussels sprouts. But I'm ready to have my head turned by something more ridiculous and flamboyant as well.
A lot of people who've lost their sight are rather scared of going into the kitchen. I wondered whether you have ever tried cooking with the lights off or in a blindfold?
Well, not, you know, I've had to cook in low light, but not, I haven't done it as an experiment. And I can see it would be frightening because you have knives and you have heat. But I think what you have to guide you, and what guides me a lot when I cook, is, you know, the smell, and actually something which is not talked about as much, but the sound. And I don't know if you find this, but I can often tell whether, if I'm not paying absolute attention to a pan, whether the onions have cooked a bit more, because the spluttering sound in the pan will change. And I can tell where things, I can tell by the sound of anything I stir in a pot before I even taste it, whether I think what stage of cooking it's got to. And I think, and certainly if you bake, you can tell a cake is ready because the smell is much more pronounced.
I'm so glad you said that, because actually I can tell when I take a chicken out of the oven, for instance, whether it's cooked through just by the way the fat is bubbling through it.
Yes.
And also by the smell.
Yes, but sound is so important when you cook, which is why I don't listen to music or anything when I cook, because you need the orchestra of the food, and that's beautiful, even before you take in how instructive it is.
And I think that's actually, again, one of the things that I like about your recipes. We aren't overburdened by having dozens and dozens and dozens of ingredients and not having to find a sighted person and say, is this tin the tomatoes or is it the coconut milk before you open it?
That must be hard. Is there any food that is braille in the packaging, in tin food and so forth, or not?
Not that I know of, but I'm not a braille user.
Right.
You can label things with barcodes,
yes,
which a reader will read to you.
Right.
Having sighted wife and daughters, I tend just to shout across the kitchen. It's the only time I allow them into the kitchen, to be honest. So it's, yes, it's if there are only a dozen ingredients, then there are fewer things to muddle up,
yeah.
I think, and fewer things to knock over as well. You're also a very practical cook. It was you who reminded me that you can actually put a plastic bag of sauce into a plastic jug in the freezer, and it won't it'll stand up straight and it won't leak all over the place. You were clearly brought up in a very sort of to hand way. If it's to hand, it's the best utensil
yes.
to use.
And I also think that I'm often at my best sort of just living off my wits, so that if I have to think, how am I going to fit that in my deep freezer, I will think, well, that's, you know, that I have to put it in a jar because otherwise it will just ooze out flat and I haven't got that much room. So often it's just having to make those constant adjustments you do just to make things work. And it's about not knowing the right way to do things. And because I've never been, I mean, I grew up cooking, but I've never been taught it in any technical or professional sense. I don't know the right way to do it, so I cobble together a way that works for me.
And if you were to buy a utensil as a Christmas present for a friend, what would be your go-to utensil to buy?
Well, it's always considered hostile to give knives to people, but I'm very keen on a mezzaluna. When I did, I mean, I don't make kitchen stuff anymore, but when I did, I made one. And that's to say, it means half moon, and it's a curved knife. And I find very good being a clumsy person. It has two handles. Everyone thinks it looks sort of lethal and that you're going to cut yourself. But actually, you can't cut yourself very easily because you haven't got a hand there to cut. So I find that useful. And you can't really sort of run over things with it. Slightly, but I'm otherwise a stick blender. You know, those immersion blenders are good. So if you're making soup, you don't have to put it in something else. You just put the blender in the saucepan. I think those sorts of things are useful. But generally, I think with gadgets, we're keen on certain things we love, and that doesn't always mean someone else will love them as much. And as I say, I gave people mezzalunas for a long time, and a lot of people just always prefer to use knives. But I think anything that enables you to sort of be more hands-on with the food and it not being tricky to use, because a lot of gadgets, I think, are quite tricky to use. But otherwise, I don't know, I think this is a very boring present, but I think smaller chopping boards. I think a lot of chopping boards are far too big and when you're just doing a certain amount, and they take up so much room on the counter. So I have chopping boards in all different sizes, and I think that's a good present.
Yes, they're also easier to wash up as well.
Yes.
Do you do your own washing up? I've always wanted to know.
Well, not when I make the TV programmes, but otherwise, yes. I mean, I have a dishwasher, but you know, everything goes in it. I don't mind washing up. What I really hate is putting things back. I don't know what that says about my character. It's, you know, I the washing up's fine, and I will leave things on the draining board, but I don't actually want to dry up.
And who's making Christmas lunch this year?
I'm making it with a friend of mine. We're getting together, so there's a group of us, and we have been apportioning tasks and, you know, foodstuffs. The difficulty is I'm worried that it was going to be rather too much. We've got two of us, you know, with saying, no, I'll do that. No, I want to do that. So I'm a bit late because I've been in Australia, but I steamed my Christmas pudding yesterday, and I will be making a huge ham. I've got a ham I cooked from a couple of books ago, when really it's very easy. You just put it in a tray lined with foil, pour black treacle over it, close up the foil and cover it, and just put it in a slow oven for a very, very long time. So I'm going to be crossing London with a very large hot ham on Christmas Day.
We will be thinking of you as you do so. So would you still hold to what you said a few years ago, which was Christmas is like the countryside, there's little to do but eat and drink?
I think that's true, but I think that's true. I'm an urban person, so I don't think it's a slur on Christmas. It's a slight slur on the countryside. Perhaps I'm being one round more to rural life, but in small doses.
Well, I shall wish you a very, very happy urban Christmas, and think of you driving across London with your ham. Nigella Lawson, thank you so much for coming into the RNIB Connect radio studios and for helping us celebrate Christmas.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Merry Christmas.
Cooking is best learnt at your own stove. You learn by watching and by doing. Chefs themselves know this. The great chefs of France and Italy learn about food at home. What they do later in the restaurants that make them famous is use what they've learnt. They build on it. They start elaborating. They take home cooking to the restaurant, not the restaurant school of cookery to the home. Inverting the process is like learning a vocabulary without any grammar. The analogy is pertinent. In years as a restaurant critic, I couldn't help noticing that however fine the menu, some chefs, for all that they seem to have mastered the idiom, have no authentic language of their own. We are at risk here of becoming a land of culinary mimics. There are some things you just cannot learn from a professional chef. I'm not talking of home economics, the rules that govern what food does when you apply heat or introduce air or whatever, but of home cooking and of how experience builds organically.
The 20th anniversary edition of How to Eat is out now in print, audio and ebook. A wide range of Nigella Lawson's books, including the original How to Eat, are available from the RNIB library in a full range of accessible formats. And I'm delighted to say that thanks to a special relationship between Penguin Random House and RNIB, Nigella's audiobook version of How to Eat will be joining them there soon. Now it's back to Nigella Lawson to share the books of her life. Nigella, was there a book that you read as a child or a young woman that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Well, I read so much as a child. I mean, I never stopped. I don't know that I'd say one particular book, but I think if I think now about the books of my childhood, the one that I return to still now, but certainly read so much as a child, is Little Women. And it's an extraordinary book that it still seems to exert so much influence or attraction to people. You know, it exerts this power because, you know, they're constantly making remakes of films and television series, but actually it's reading the book. Now, of course, when I read the book now, there's a lot in it. There is a lot in Little Women that drives me absolutely mad. And yet I think it is so much a part of me. I mean, I think all... When you're growing up as a girl, you know, all girls do at some stage identify with one of the characters. It's nearly always Jo. But I'm always fascinated when I meet women to know which character, you know, they identified with. And it can be quite telling.
I shall have a new ribbon for my hair, and Mommy will lend me her little pearl pin. And my new slippers are lovely, and my gloves will do, though they aren't as nice as I'd like. Mine are spoilt with lemonade, and I can't get any new ones, so I shall have to go without, said Jo, who never troubled herself much about dress. You must have gloves, or I won't go, said Meg decidedly. Gloves are more important than anything else. You can't dance without them, and if you don't, I should be so mortified. Then I'll stay still. I don't much care for company dancing. It's no fun to go sailing round. I like to fly about and cut capers. You can't ask Mother for new ones. They're so expensive, and you are so careless. She said when you spoilt the others that she shouldn't get you any more this winter. Can't you make them do? Asked Meg anxiously.
Little Women by Louisa May Alcott is available from the library in a full range of accessible formats, including as TB21665, narrated by Liza Ross. And is there a book that on a cold and rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread as comfort food?
I think that would have to be David Copperfield. I think it's an extraordinary novel. It's absolutely a very true story of someone becoming a person. And it doesn't surprise me that it was Freud's favourite novel. I've reread it at regular intervals, and I always find something new there. And it's tremendously sad and tremendously funny. I think that anyone who hasn't read David Copperfield is in for such a treat. I'm almost unbearably envious of someone reading it for the first time.
Whether I shall turn out to be the hero of my own life or whether that station will be held by anybody else, these pages must show. To begin my life with the beginning of my life, I record that I was born, as I have been informed and believe, on a Friday at 12 o'clock at night. It was remarked that the clock began to strike and I began to cry simultaneously. In consideration of the day and hour of my birth, it was declared by the nurse and by some sage women in the neighbourhood who had taken a lively interest in me several months before there was any possibility of our becoming personally acquainted, first, that I was destined to be unlucky in life, and secondly, that I was privileged to see ghosts and spirits. Both these gifts inevitably attaching, as they believe, to all unlucky infants of either gender born towards the small hours on a Friday night. I need say nothing here on the first head, because nothing can show better than my history whether that prediction was verified or falsified by the result. On the second branch of the question, I will only remark that unless I ran through that part of my inheritance while I was still a baby, I have not come into it yet. But I do not at all complain of having been kept out of this property, and if anybody else should be in the present enjoyment of it, he is heartily welcome to keep it.
David Copperfield, written by Charles Dickens and narrated by Nigel Carrington, is TB14499. It's also available in Braille and giant print. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'll be sharing with others for Christmas?
Well, it's not a recent book, but I read it fairly recently, maybe last year, and it's a book I can't stop giving to people. I give it to people compulsively. It's The Signature of All Things by Elizabeth Gilbert. And I feel that this is a book that has not been given the credit that it should have. And I think that's because a lot of people are quite snobbish. Her big hit was Eat, Pray, Love, and people feel they judge in advance what kind of a book they think it's going to be. And The Signature of All Things is the most astonishing story, hugely ambitious, so extraordinarily evocative. You travel to places just through the words enormously. You learn about things. Who knew that you could read a book and become intrigued by mosses? It's a story of difficulty of being in the world and loneliness, but also how much there is in the world and what beauty there is to feed on. And it's an extraordinary book, and I give it to a lot of people. I'm very excited always to hear what they thought of it. And when you give a book, you know that will last in someone. I think in literary criticism terms it's called, it has residue. That's the biggest present you can give.
Henry Whittaker was born in 1760 in the village of Richmond, just up the Thames from London. He was the youngest son of poor parents, who had a few too many children already. He was raised in two small rooms, with a floor of beaten earth, with an almost adequate roof, with a meal on the hearth nearly every day, with a mother who did not drink, and a father who did not beat his family. By comparison to many families of the day, in other words, a nearly genteel existence. His mother even had a private spot of dirt behind the house in which to grow larkspurs and lupines, decoratively, like a lady. But Henry was not fooled by larkspurs and lupines. He grew up sleeping one wall away from the pigs, and there was not a moment in his life when poverty did not humiliate him.
The Signature of All Things by Elizabeth Gilbert is available commercially in print and ebook, and as an audiobook narrated by Juliet Stevenson. Well, Nigella Lawson, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading with the Read On listeners, and for being a guest on RNIB Connect Radio.